you know, Tattoo You is generally considered to be sort of the last great Rolling Stones album. And it's crazy that it even became an album at all.
That is the voice of rock journalist Alan Light reflecting on the Rolling Stones album, Tattoo You, 40 years. Yes, 40 years after it was released on August 24th, 1981. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I'm your host, Rob Bob, the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll music. Great to have you joining us. And you can find Rock Conversations wherever you get your podcasts. iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, you name it, we're there. So Tattoo You has always been one of those, dare I say, special albums for me. I was young when I got it. It was actually my grandma Kovach, who was looking after my sister and me in Winona. And she took us shopping with my grandpa. And we went to a store, I think its name was Tempo, kind of fitting when you think that it involves music in this case. But it was not a music-only store, it was a department store. And I convinced her that she should buy me the cassette of this new Rolling Stones album, Tattoo You. I'm sure she had absolutely no clue who the Rolling Stones were, or any clue that they had just released an album, Tattoo You. But it has become, it quickly became, and has remained one of my favorite albums of all time. Maybe there's some sentimental value in it. Maybe it has to do when I purchased it in my lifetime. I'm not a huge fan of Start Me Up. Great song, but not a huge fan, even though it was the first song on my mix for the first marathon I ever ran, the Chicago Marathon, back in 2006, I think it was. Coldplay's The Hardest Part was the second song. Go figure. I think I was a little, about 4 hours away from The Hardest Part. Nonetheless, I love Tattoo You. The cassette is still in one of my cars, which has a cassette deck. Yes, my 1984 Jaguar XJ6 still has a cassette deck. Car doesn't run or hasn't run lately, but I think the cassette deck does, and so does the cassette Tattoo You. So without further ado, let's talk about the Rolling Stones' Tattoo You with Alan Light 40 years after its release.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
You wrote a great piece for Esquire, and we'll put the link in our description of this episode for those who want to read it. You should read it, listeners. 40 years since the release of Tattoo You, and it came together in, as you describe, a most unlikely way. Tell us more.
Yeah, I think, you know, Tattoo You is generally considered to be sort of the last great Rolling Stones album. And it's crazy that it even became an album at all. It's a record that was done under really, let's say, challenging circumstances, both creatively and personally for the band at this point. They had a big stadium tour scheduled. They wanted to use that to promote an album. How's that for a different model than where we are today, by the way?
Can you imagine that? We've got this tour booked, but we don't have a new album.
So we better get an album out, because that's how we sell an album, is by going out on tour. But that's the way that it worked. And this was a point where the relationship between Mick Jagger and Keith Richards was, you know, in full breakdown. Keith had sort of rebounded back from his drug years in the 70s. As he writes about in his book, he didn't like that Mick felt like he was running the band and making all the decisions. And, you know, as he writes in his memoir, he says Mick was becoming unbearable around this time. So they were barely speaking, much less writing songs. And Ronnie Wood was going into a bad drug phase of his own. So to try to get a record done, their engineer, Chris Kimsey, had the idea, let me go back through the outtakes and the stuff that didn't get finished for the last few records and see if I can find stuff that's close enough that we can make an album out of it. And, you know, sort of miraculously got something together that really mostly Mick finished writing lyrics and recording vocals, that not only became their second best-selling album, but is the, you know, sort of hangs together and feels like an album that's constructed out of all these spare parts.
Do you think it was a situation similar to Fleetwood Mac's recording of Rumors, where you had the bandmates at odds, but somehow artistically it comes together?
I mean, maybe so, but that was the, you know, the miracle of Rumors is this was all of these relationships that were falling apart, but they were stuck in a room having to record together. This, you know, with Tattoo You, it was almost the workaround of how can we get a record done without having to make them collaborate. And the answer, you know, the solution seemed to be, let's find stuff that's decent and mostly finished, and they can polish it off, you know, again, really mostly Mick, and then whatever other final pieces need to be done from the others, that it can get done with the, you know, the least of a nightmare of trying to put them in a studio together. Everything would indicate that that would be, you know, you could do it, but it's going to feel like odds and ends and scraps and stuff that was recorded 6 years apart that has no business, you know, sitting together on a record, which fine could be a certain sort of a thing. And yet the there was a consistency, there was a coherence to this record that resulted in a huge success and oddly a kind of, you know, again, a kind of consistency and through line that they really haven't been able to replicate in the years since then.
You make a confession in your article in Esquire that you've never really liked Start Me Up.
I admit it in the intro,
it's never been my favorite song from the album.
I mean, functionally, I get it. I get it as show opener. You know, I understand why it works. But Start Me Up has always felt to me like sort of the beginning of the self-conscious, you know, we're the Rolling Stones and, you know, we'll create something that'll please the crowd in that sort of a way. It's fine. I just don't think, you know, Start Me Up ain't Jumpin' Jack Flash, and people act like it is. And I just
know it ain't,
you know, and fine. It works, you know, if it works for the generation that it works for, it became one of the iconic riffs and iconic songs. To me, that's not in any way the most memorable thing about Tattoo You. I think the most interesting thing about this album is the second side, which is all ballads. This is really a record that's split into the rock side and the ballad side. And the ballad side really doesn't sound like anything else that the Stones ever did before or since, and really sits as sort of, you know, such an interesting moment in their catalog, a direction that they really didn't pursue that much after. But I think going back is actually the extraordinary part of this album.
Well, it's interesting that you wrote about the second side and the ballads, and you talked about it obviously right here, because I have to make another confession. I have the cassette of Tattoo You, and I rarely have listened to the second side. You know, obviously I've heard Waiting on a Friend over and over.
Right.
So I need to now go back to it and listen to it. Let's talk about the rock side though, if we could. Two of my favorites, and I'd like to get your thoughts on your favorites, but two of my favorites are Slave, just kind of that driving rhythm. And I think Keith really shines in a number of ways in Little TNA, and the humor is not lost on the song's title.
I think, you know, what's interesting about those two songs I mentioned in the piece is I feel like if you're listening to Tattoo You knowing that it came out of the sessions from the last five albums, there are places where you can hear, oh, now I hear why that would have been part of this album or that album. And Slave, when you hear it and you think, oh, of course that was done during the Black and Blue sessions where they were doing these kind of jammy groove songs. It was the album that was the audition record for the new guitar players that, you know, the slot that ended up going to Ronnie Wood. But you hear that song and you're like, oh, I see where that would have come out of the kind of songs on Black and Blue that they were doing. Or Little TNA was something that didn't make, you know, or started life with Emotional Rescue. If you hear that sort of jittery guitar part, that could be the next song after She's So Cold.
I was going to say the exact same thing.
Very easily, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
So you start to connect the dots of, oh, I see where that sound came out of that session or this came out of that period. And that's, you know, so that's sort of an interesting thing. you know, on the rock songs, I quote the review at the time from the great Robert Palmer, who was the New York Times rock critic at the time, and, you know, for my money, the best ever to do this job. And he points out that, you know, Tatsuyu, the rock songs aren't, it isn't them doing a disco song or them doing a reggae song. So much of the 70s was the Stones kind of chasing these genres, like trying to keep up with a lot of the new directions or different directions in music. And maybe that's why these songs didn't make the cut on the albums that they were intended for. But even the, you know, the not great rock songs on Tatsuyu, they still just kind of sound like Rolling Stones songs. They don't sound like here's the Stones doing this thing or that thing. It just sounds like these come out of their influences and their feel. And that was a thing that, you know, they'd kind of gotten away from on a lot of the previous albums. Some Girls Notwithstanding, which is the, you know, the triumph of the 70s for sure. But on a lot of the others, you feel them playing catch up. And on these songs, I you know, even the ones that aren't A-list Stone songs, I think you don't feel that.
You mentioned in your piece, we're talking with Alan Light, who's written a great little piece about the 40th anniversary of Tatsuyu. You mentioned in that story that No Use in Crime, but Heaven is the third most streamed cut on the album. I presume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Start Me Up is probably number one. What's number two?
Well, Waiting on a Friend, of course, okay. was the other big hit. I get it. Those are the big singles. Heaven is so far, I mean, such a weird song and so far out of whack with, you know, the streams on the others that I kept looking, was it used on a soundtrack? Like, and I can't find anything, if anybody can help. But it's so sort of anomalous looking at the rest of the streaming numbers that I feel like there's got to be something else that's been pointing to that song, because why does it jump out of, you know, the, especially out of this set of ballads? But there it is, for whatever reason, that seems to be the one that people are finding.
Final thoughts, anything that that you want to add on this this 40th anniversary of the release of Tatsuyu?
I got to say, mostly, I'm just surprised. I mean, Esquire asked me to do this piece and happy to do it. And it's a fascinating story to tell because it's such a strange way that this album came together. That I'm getting so much reaction to. My editor wrote and said, this piece is blowing up for us. It's like been the second, you know, most read piece all day for the site. I would not have anticipated that there's still that much fascination around this record 40 years later, but apparently it still holds for, you know, for our generation. This was one of the first Stones records that we remember happening sort of in real time. It was the last one of this scale. It was their last number one album. And so I guess that whatever it is, there's still a curiosity and some sort of a affinity for this album that I wasn't quite expecting.
Well, I got to say, I'd given absolutely no thought to the fact that it was 40 years ago. And I feel a little dated that way. And then I saw your post on Facebook this morning and, you know, to let our listeners in on a couple secrets. So number one, I didn't plan on this interview. Number two, you were kind enough to do it on short notice. And number three, we have a much longer interview with you in the can that we're going to use in the future on Rock Conversations. We have not forgotten about that interview, but we're just staggering a few of the releases. So, Alan, it's
whatever you need from me.
It's great to talk with you again. And thanks for sharing your insights into one of my favorite albums of all time.
Thank you so much.